All right. Thanks, everybody, for being here, by the way. This is great. Who here has listened to this show before? Oh, wait, I have something else for you. Okay, so we got a few people. A few people haven't before. So it's very conversational. We're just going to go. I will probably do some audience stuff as well, since you're all here and you decided to schlep yourselves in. So you know, getting nervous. All right. So without further ado, then, what we're going to do is we're going to get started in 3, 2, 1.
Through dangers untold and hardships unknown, I have fought my way here to the castle beyond the Goblin City. Take back the child that you have stolen.
Okay, Retro, go. Let's go.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen Live in Las Vegas. It's a show where we talk about movies, but specifically we talk about a movie at least one of us has never seen before. I'm your host Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 267. And our movie this week is 1986's Labyrinth, directed by Jim Henson. And here to talk with me about it, because neither one of them had seen it somehow.
Yeah, somehow.
First, we have Joe.
Hello.
Hi. And Shane.
Hello there.
All right. So, I'm going to start with you. How did you not ever see Labyrinth? Is it not? Are you a Muppet fan at all?
Absolutely a Muppet fan. I have no idea because I hadn't seen The Dark Crystal up until the last few years, I want to say.
Okay.
No idea how I missed these, though, honestly.
All right. Joe, how did you not see it? That was the more surprising one to me.
Yeah. I'm sure on your show sometime I've told the story where when I was a child, the Muppet Show was on TV, like normal broadcasting, and when it moved from being a 7 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. show, mm-hmm. I campaigned in my house that my bedtime was not 7:30 at night, but was after the Muppets whenever that ended. So I was an addicted Muppet fan. I think two things happened. So 86, I would have been in junior high or so.
Okay.
So I don't know that I tracked that this was a Jim Henson thing. I'm not sure I was actually aware of it. I don't think my family didn't really care about bringing me to movies. I had to like argue and just get excited and be like, hey, I want to go. So I think that was it. And then because it was the 80s, you know, it happened. And then you got it on VHS if you went to the store and picked it up. It wasn't nearly as available as we think of things are now. So I just never noticed it when I was a kid. And then in the last, you know, several decades of my adulthood, it takes a lot for me to stop and sit down and watch a movie nowadays.
That's fair. Yeah, so I did see this when I was a kid. It was one that I loved growing up. I loved Henson. I loved the Muppets. I watched the Muppet Show. I watched Muppet Babies on Saturday morning cartoons when I was a kid. I remember even, there was the Storyteller, but there was another show that he did similar to that, wasn't there? The Jim Henson Hour. And I watched a lot of the Jim Henson Hour. I remember that. But this one was one I remember seeing as a kid, and I just loved it. And I had, because Shane, like you, I hadn't seen The Dark Crystal until just a few years ago.
Right.
Which always I knew of it, and I quoted that movie having not seen it. But this one was a lot of fun, so it was really cool to get both of you to watch this. So Joe, first off, I want to know just overall impression. What did you think watching it for the first time now?
So I on Saturday night sat down with my wife and my daughter. My son, teenage son, mysteriously had something else to do than watch an 80s movie with his dad.
Right.
My daughter lasted 45 minutes. She's 13, and honestly, that was good for her. Overall, it just nostalgia bomb's not the right word because it didn't remind me of anything specific, but the whole movie is a vibe. It feels like, I think I put here like a sound bath of emotion. It's like an old school fairy tale, and I looked and, you know, Henson wrote it himself, but it feels like a fairy tale, but not the ones the Grimms wrote where someone ends up dismembered tragically. Like, it's a, but you feel like maybe that story was underneath this one at some point. You could see how this could have turned into something where you got turned into stone because you made a bad decision about your stepmother.
Right.
But it was just, I loved it. It was wonderful. It just made me happy throughout the whole thing.
Excellent. Shane, how about you? What were your first thoughts watching this for the first time now as an adult?
I think the biggest takeaway right off the bat was this looked good. Mm-hmm. Like, and I had to look it up at the CGI. This was like one of the first attempts at it, apparently.
So that the shattering glass CGI felt like they put it in just because they could.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought it looked fantastic, even from the beginning with the owl, like the animated owls and everything. That was my biggest takeaway. But it was surprisingly different than Dark Crystal. You know, not really what I expected overall, though. But we can get more into that.
Yeah, Joe, you nailed it. It's very much like a classic fairy tale. And it's a lot of emotion in there for Sarah, played by Jennifer Connelly, and kind of what she's going through. Because she started the movie, she's not really she's almost unlikable.
Almost,
yeah.
All right.
She's in
time. I was being kind because it's Jennifer Connelly, and I may or may not have had a gigantic crush on her that I still do.
I was gonna say
so. But then you also had David Bowie, who I also may or may not have a gigantic crush on.
Sure,
it's David Bowie. But she's very, like, she's almost bratty at the beginning and just not great. And we have to follow her journey. And I just love the emotion that you get in that that whole thing as she, because it's her half brother, and she's what, 15 years older than him.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a toddler, and I can't imagine. I have a younger sister, but she's only a couple years younger than me, so I can't imagine that big of an age gap and kind of having to deal with that, as well as sort of, you know, a stepmother, which we don't really in the movie explore a whole lot of the family thing. It's all in the fantasy world.
They definitely leaned on both the fairy tale evil stepmother trope and placing this in the 80s. Like, the stepmom in the 80s was an archetype, and it was always, I mean, right, the only thing we get from that the stepmother's bad is her going, well, I'm not, she always tries to make me the evil stepmother. I think it was very expository, but also a quick blip, and the scene is set. Sarah is some version of Cinderella. She's got, you know, a dad who presumably loves her and a stepmom who's annoying. Did you notice her mom, Sarah's mom? I found this out afterwards looking at stuff. There are photos and stories of her mom on her mirror in her bedroom.
Yeah.
Which feels like something to talk about if we get into the set and the background stuff, because there's so much detail in all that.
Well, and, you know, Shane, you mentioned how good the movie looks. Mm-hmm. And there is some early CG. That animated owl at the beginning and where it transitions to a real owl is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But Henson and his puppets and his Muppets were so good all throughout this. And he was always pushing the boundaries of what he could do with them on screen.
Right.
And, like, Hoggle is phenomenal. Mm. That head, and I'm sure Amy and Chuck know a lot more about it than I do. But I just, every time I watch this movie, I'm so fascinated by, like, that particular piece. To have that and have somebody wearing that while it's being puppeteered, and that compactness, and then just the expressiveness that they can get out of everything, whether it's Hoggle, whether it's the door knockers, or something as simple as, like, the little creatures that were moving the stones around as she was marking them walking around. Like, it's just
hands,
so great.
The hands in the pit. that was amazed me how they made faces and spoke, and they were each a different face, and they all worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. That made me, it felt like 100% a Muppet thing and absolutely spectacular.
Yeah,
for sure.
Because they were. Each one was a distinct different face and a different voice and a different personality. And to think that it's all this personality out of these things that are either just a group of hands or, you know, a puppet, but they can get so much, and it's because everybody buys into it. And that's what makes it work.
I don't want to jump past the door knockers right away, because, like, I want to emphasize how good those looked for that time. I was the whole time I was like, did they George Lucas this? Like, did they go back later? This doesn't feel like, if you watch it, it looks really good. Like, mm-hmm. the metallicness and everything, it's crazy.
Yeah, all of it does. Ludo looks amazing and is such a fun character, too.
I love Ludo. He does. He's like, a little bit like Sweetum from the Muppets,
yep.
in, mm-hmm. in his physicality. And I looked like Ludo singing to the stones and having them come was such a sweet bit of character for the big monstrous creature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the, a big part of it is there's so much emotion around all of the characters. They all have that, whether it's Hoggle, because Hoggle is self-proclaimed a coward. Mm-hmm. He's Jareth scares him. but he does have, like, you know, there's a heart of gold in there, and he wants to help.
Yeah.
But he's afraid.
Nobody ever gets his name right.
Nope.
Yep.
Is this where Hogwarts came from?
Does I was thinking know? The That's, same thing.
Because yep. if it isn't, I mean, if you asked me, I would put money down on that.
Yeah.
And I always forget that every time I see it. I don't know why. I never remember. And then the first time she calls him Hogwart, I'm like, yeah. is it?
Right.
I don't know.
Real quick, Travis, not to interject, but
no,
do you
want to
talk
away.
About how this is like a year in the making of us watching this?
Oh, the actual.
Oh, yeah. So doing this actual podcast, we talked about this, I think, last year here in Las Vegas at karaoke mm-hmm. night.
Right.
We were sitting around talking about it, and then a year went by. I forget everything that I'm ever told. So when it was coming up that, I might try and do the show this year in Las Vegas. And then, Shane, you reminded me, like, hey, we talked about doing Labyrinth last year, and the light bulb went off. I'm like, yes, we'll make that happen.
And I think both times it got misconstrued with the Dark Crystal.
Yes,
absolutely. Which you have done.
Yes, I have done that because I hadn't seen it. So, no, this was a year in the making, and I love the fact that we get to, you know, you get to see, like, and Joe, as somebody who grew up loving the Muppets so much,
yeah.
getting to see this, because there's one thing when you see them on the show in the small screen and what they're constrained by, mm-hmm. but when they get to open it up and you get to see and they get to build these elaborate, just gorgeous sets.
Oh, yeah.
And create this, and putting it in a fantasy world, much like what he did with the Dark Crystal a few years earlier, is brilliant because it gives you a clean slate to just do whatever you want. You don't have, and some of that works, some of it doesn't. I do think Labyrinth does have a little pacing trouble at times, especially for somebody seeing it now for the first time.
The opening credits were, I think, 5.5 minutes long. That was the first question my daughter was like, when is the movie going to start? Why are we?
I think I had the same thought.
And that is very much a product of its time. Like,
absolutely.
You don't get that
absolutely.
Anymore. But even like, there's the moment about an hour in where she runs into the what would you call it? Like the fire creatures?
Oh, yeah, the fireys.
Yeah, the fireys.
Guys with the tossing heads around.
Yeah. Like, I love the scene, but it brings everything kind of comes to a screeching halt. We have this scene, and then we move on. Like, well, that happened,
mm-hmm.
And we're just never going to talk about it again.
Right. They just show up at the end when all the friends hang out in
yeah.
the bedroom.
Which, and it also, I think, visually, they just didn't have quite the technology they needed to really pull it off fully. So it is the one spot in the movie where you can see, like, you see a lot of the composition
mm-hmm.
And the composited shots and all that. And I think even just a few years later, it could have looked so much better. But at the same time, like, that's Henson saying, well, I've got an hour and 40-minute runtime. I can put this in here.
Mm-hmm.
You throw stuff against the wall, see what works. Visually, like, the concept of it is amazing. I love it. I actually saw a few weeks ago, I was at a convention, and somebody had plushies of the Fieries, and they were Velcroed together, so you could pop the arms off, the head off, and all that.
Well, that's
it was nice. Really cool. I almost bought one. did you have a favorite character in the movie? Joe, you started smiling, so I feel like you wrote something down.
Well, I was actually smiling because I was going to ask the same question, but then I realized it wasn't my show, it was yours.
it's both of ours. We just keep it at my house.
I'm trying to think of a favorite. I'm not. Shane, do you have an answer while I think?
Well, I mean, Ludo immediately jumps to mind, but I think it's maybe a toss-up between him and Hoggle, right?
Yeah, I mean, Ludo is great. I just and I'm a sucker for the big, full body Muppets, Sweetums, Ludo, the Ghost of Christmas Present, I love those Muppets so much, and Ludo is fantastic.
Then there's Sir Didymus also.
Sir Didymus. I think for me, I think it might be Sir Didymus. He had a little kind of Don Quixote about him. I actually was looking up names to make sure I had them right, and when I looked up Didymus, I found all this like Greek mythology and Christian theologians with that name, and now I've not gone down this path, but I'm going to start looking at like what the knowing Jim Henson, there's got to be some lore and connection in the naming that goes back.
Absolutely.
But I don't know. I think more than him, and this might be a cop-out, the Goblin Chorus. I loved the Goblin Chorus.
All of the goblins.
I could pick out the occasional little, pod people and Gelfling in the, reused materials of critters in there. But they were just so much fun and just a wonderful use of... I mean, it was just a wonderful chorus to sit there with Bowie and with Jareth.
Well, and the thing with all the goblins that I love so much is that they all have, again, like the Helping Hands, distinct personalities. Mm-hmm. And, like, if you're writing this out and you can just say, well, there's a goblin chorus, but then as they start making it, you get all these individual characters. And so it adds so much, like, depth and color to everything to have these wonderful characters for a little throwaway gag, like when they're all waiting for her at the beginning when she's holding Toby, mm-hmm. and she's not quite saying the words, she's not saying I wish, and just them, they can just hear her. We don't get any explanation, don't need one, and I love that scene because there's so much going on every time they cut to the goblins, and you've got like the one who doesn't, there's always the one that has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Which, he was my favorite of the Goblin Chorus, by far. Sir Didymus is great. I love Ambrosius, though.
Oh, sure.
Oh, is, yeah. And, again, there's one where you can clearly tell when they had a real dog versus the puppet. And I love that. Because, like, when he runs and hides.
Right, yeah.
Is one of my favorite moments. Where he keeps peeking around the corner and he's like, nope, I'm not doing it. Uh-uh. Like, he's just great. He's probably, him and Didymus are my favorite characters. Because, again, the Don Quixote... And he, like, one of the things I was going to capture the audio of when at the final battle in the city, when the spear comes over and just taps him on the shoulder, Sir Didymus, as he's at the door.
Right.
And he turns around to six guys with spears, and he's like, well, if you throw down your weapons, I'll see that you're treated fairly.
Yep, yep.
He does not know that he is a foot and a half tall. And even if he did, he doesn't care. And I love that about him. So he's probably my favorite character. The sets, the look of everything, that labyrinth, like even just the beginning, the first part when she walks into the labyrinth and you get the endless corridor in both directions, mm-hmm. you feel her, like she's starting and she's already behind the eight ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything grows out of that.
Interject for a second, even mm-hmm. farther back than that, the opening scene where she's rehearsing lines in this meadow with a obelisk there for some reason, and then she realizes she's late and runs off, and she is in this picturesque, it felt like a New England town to me, just even the spot they chose for the mundane world
mm-hmm.
was beautiful and immersive and set a scene. And again, it felt like it connected it to other 80s movies where you understood the language of the place, even though they didn't explain it. It never really mattered afterwards because the labyrinth is where everything important happens.
Yeah. And but, I think that's smart to do that and get you into the tone and into the mood of what your movie is going to be already. Like, the real world we see is a little fantastic. And the house that they lived in. What did her dad do is what I want to know. Because that house was huge. But then that sets you up to then go to the world of the labyrinth. And I love, too, that it's just like we just go there, and that's it. We don't need explanations. We don't need a bunch of backstory to that. Just let us – put us in that world, and let's just tell this story, because that's what's – the important part is Sarah's emotional journey through everything. Mm-hmm. Her journey is what we care about, not how she got there or what's going on in that respect. So I really like that. Did you have kind of a favorite set? Because there's a few different ones, and there's the labyrinth. Then when they get to, like, it's more of a hedge maze area of the labyrinth. The Bog of Eternal Stench, which is a wonderful running joke. And Hoggle, by the way, I understand why Hoggle does not want to go to the Bog of Eternal Stench. If I had a nose that size, the last place I want to be is somewhere that stinks constantly. Like,
yeah, but it ended up being Ludo that complained about it the most, it seemed like.
Well, you know, he's got a good sense of smell. Yeah, I loved all of the locations. And it's all on sound stages, mm-hmm. and it works. It doesn't matter. But it's such an immersive world. And he did the same thing with the Dark Crystal, too. And putting us in that world and populating it with these wonderful characters. And again, little things like the two doorways where it was the heads on top and the bottom.
Yeah.
And they're bickering and arguing with each other, and they do the, you know, he always lies, one of us always lies, one of us always tells the truth riddle. Even that, and the way that everything would move. So, again, because it's a fantasy world, you can just have that happen where she's standing there and it's like, wait, this was a dead end. No, the dead end's behind you. And it doesn't, like, it's got to be a continuity nightmare to try and film that, though.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that.
There were multiple, like, two option pathways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right at the beginning, and then two separate times with doors, I think, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, because the knockers mm-hmm, were two right. different doors she could go through. And it was always, it seemed like every time you go through a door, everything went bad. Fall through the floor, mm-hmm. and things are just going to go horrible.
So I was thinking about that with the one guy tells the truth, one guy lies. That whole scene was really interesting to me in that, one, she's like, oh, yeah, I don't need to worry about this. I know the answer. Like, I've studied intro philosophy. And she went straight to it, and there wasn't much going on. And if I recall, she kind of got the right answer, but then it felt like, oh, no, I'm falling. But it turned out being right. She did not go to certain doom. She followed the path she needed to go through. It just ended up involving some scary stuff along the way.
Yeah.
And I thought about that afterwards, because my first thought when she fell down the hole, I was like, wait a minute. She got the right answer right. What are they doing to her? But then from a morals of the story perspective, I was like, oh, wait, you can get the right answer, still be have problems afterwards, and then get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
I loved, well, I think for set, I would say those hands, I don't know if they count as a set or a character. They were amazing. One of my favorite little snips of a scene and also sets was the worm at the beginning that helped her get mm-hmm. past the first.
Chuck is wearing the worm on a shirt.
Nice. The worm, and not just the worm, but the like coral eyeballs that were there that just never were called out. And in the beginning, and that's something I think Henson does really well, is he has stuff happening in the background that doesn't get called out, doesn't get even brought forward. It just happens, and it rewards you for paying attention.
Yeah, and it doesn't work. It's not required to be there,
right?
He doesn't have to go that hard, but he does, and it makes it so much better, because when she walks by and you just get all the little eyes follow her
mm-hmm.
for a quick second. That was the other thing. I did manage to capture this, which is I'm gonna play this real quick because this is too much fun.
Did you say hello?
No, I said hello, but that's close enough.
I love him. I'm changing my answer. He's my favorite character in that little guy.
Yeah.
Because right after that, he helps her figure out that there is a path beyond the one she's on,
mm-hmm.
which is a great shot, by the way. Like that forced perspective of here's the just blank wall, and she completely buys that it's there and then can just walk forward and
right.
realize, oh, no, it's not. There's another path there.
That was another cool effect, actually.
Yeah. And then she starts to walk down the one way, and the worm's like, no, don't go that way. Never go that way. And so she just goes the other way, and I love that, because then you get the, if she'd gone that way, she'd have gone right to that castle.
Yeah,
right.
And then we wouldn't have a movie. So we needed that. So, like, the fantasy elements of it are great, but there's also, you know, it's Sarah's story. And it's Sarah wrestling with, like, she is an older sister. She and is asked to babysit, and she is 16 at this point. So she's wanting to have more of her own life, but she still feels like she's being held back by her parents. So it's that growth that she needs to go through, and she has to go through it by saying, hey, I want my brother to disappear, because she lives in that fantasy world. And it's the scene where, so after she eats the peach that Jareth had enchanted, and it takes her to the masquerade party.
Right.
That was a scene that I didn't appreciate as much when I was younger, because it felt like it took me out of, I'm having fun with, you know, all the silly Muppets and the adventure of the story, and then suddenly we're at a masquerade, like, dance. I'm like, what is this? I don't care about this or this song, which, you know, now as I've gotten older, I appreciate that song a lot more. But what she goes through there, and then subsequently in the, like, junkyard with all the the old junk ladies or whatever. I can't remember what they were called. It was junk ladies. Good. Like, for her to go through, and she's basically getting what she wants at that masquerade party, and then realizing that it may be what she wants, it's not what she needs right now. And she's able to break away from that, but then she's all confused, and she has to deal with the junk ladies. And, like, that scene is great when she goes into her room, and it's that false ending of, oh, it was just a dream, I'm home. And then it all comes crashing down around. I love that. Then the reveal of it for her, when she's sitting in front of her mirror, and junk ladies piling stuff on her, and you realize she's getting turned into a junk lady herself, and then when everything just breaks and falls apart behind her, and that room blows up. I love that.
That was an amazing scene. Like, both that whole part, the calling out the junk lady. I didn't notice the junk lady was carrying her own junk, her own stuff on her as much. She kind of just looked like some weird little turtle thing. But then when she was piling the emotional baggage on Sarah, and the different this is something dear to you. Oh, this is another thing that you love a lot. Hold on to this, and let me put this on there. One of those things was the Wizard of Oz book, noticed, which was great. Like, it was a very nice connection. And watching them, like, I've talked about emotional baggage as barnacles when I've talked to people about sort of getting past their past, and that totally is what that felt like. We're just going to keep growing on you with all this stuff you just never want to let go of.
Yeah.
Until you're waddling around and can't accomplish anything.
And emotional baggage, and also in a way too, you can look at that as, like, well, nostalgia as well, and how that can be. Nostalgia is great. I mean, I'm doing this right now talking about this movie that I love so much. But it's the balancing of that. You can have that, but don't overdo it. If you start latching on too much to all of that stuff and never let yourself grow, you're just going to get weighed down by it and be wandering around a junkyard for the rest of your life, which doesn't sound very fun.
Wow. That's deep.
Got heavy for you.
That one, when I talked earlier about this felt like it could be a classic grim fairy tale where if you made the wrong decision, you ended up, you know, dismembered. That fairy dance that felt like an old fey court story where, you know, the old Irish stories were when you mess with the fairies, they feel like they're benign, but if you eat something they give to you, you're trapped forever. There was a lot of that sort of hidden sense of danger in the fantasy that was there that got conveyed, not aggressively, but like, oh, this is really nice. Maybe it's not nice. I'm not sure.
Right.
And yeah, that was so good.
And one of the things I love that Jim Henson would do is he wasn't afraid to get a little bit darker and get scary. And he had a thought of, look, kids can be scared and it's fine. It's not a bad thing. It's actually good to do on occasion. Don't overdo it, but you don't want to overdo scaring anybody, but allow them to feel those emotions. And that, I think, is why his stuff works so well over the generations and still is good today, is because he wasn't averse to we're going to get a little bit dark, and it's going to get a little bit scary for kids. It might be too intense for some, but it works. And then you can appreciate that later as well, and you can see kind of the layers to that.
They also said the D word in this movie.
Which D word?
Am I allowed to say it here?
Go for it.
Damn.
Yep.
Oh. Yeah, I was thinking of a different D word.
They didn't say that one. They just showed it a lot. Okay? Because, look, I mean, David Bowie's... They cast David Bowie and his package for this movie. It was on prominent display. You can't get around that.
So... It occurs to me that we've gone this far and haven't really talked about him at all, which is weird.
It is a little bit, but he was fantastic. He was perfectly cast as Jareth, and you can tell he's just having fun. Dance Magic Dance is an amazing song, and that
and
whole...
Now it's in my head.
Yep, and it will remind be for the rest me of the day. Yes.
Of that baby.
But that's such a fun scene to do, and it's and intercutting it with her, but also it's a great musical scene. And when Muppets work, when you get Michael Caine in Muppet Christmas Carol, where he's going for it, he is acting amidst all of the Muppets, and that's perfect. And David Bowie does that here, where he is Jareth through and through. And then he's like, I mean it's a simple one, but he's dancing around and he just punts one of the goblins. Just sends that thing flying. It cracks me up every single time. And I also always notice the doll when he's tossing the baby at the end.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yep, there's a doll, because that hair is completely different. But yeah, David Bowie was fantastic.
So my wife and I had a conversation afterwards about David Bowie's balls. and I don't... The
Not
crystal,
those.
The crystal balls.
Yes.
Sorry, I...
Okay, also those.
I saw that opening as I was saying it, and I had to just go right through it. But the tactile juggling that happened, that Jareth did, and we were debating about whether or not that was legitimately, whether it was David Bowie, who I thought most of it was, and she's like, you could totally see like someone else's arm reaching up from behind him and doing those things. But it was very interesting, that bit of character, and again, that bit of artifice from Henson, where if anyone's going to be able to pull off a clean and legitimate, this person, this is someone else's hand doing something,
right?
It's someone from Muppet Works.
And I know it was a fairly well-known juggler, that Michael Motion, thank you, who did that juggling. And I think I've seen a few clips of like behind the scenes as they were doing it, because that had to have been difficult. He's got to stand behind and just have his arms out in front doing this. He can't see what he's doing. But yeah, that was a fun bit of character, and it added a lot, and it just looks cool.
It does. And I imagine at that point in time, that was something that wasn't, you know, there weren't 40,000 music festivals where people were doing that to EDM every summer. Like, that was something you didn't see very much.
Well, and there wasn't even just the proliferation of finding videos of people doing stuff around. Like, there were people doing it, but we didn't have access to seeing so much of it. So it would have looked, it adds to that otherworldly feel of Jareth is able to just do this. And to have it be so smooth and just part of who he is, he just does it as like a show-off move while he's talking to her, is great. Yeah, I love the juggling and all that. So, all right, I want to ask, because we got some audience members here. We're doing this live in Vegas. So show of hands, who hasn't seen Labyrinth before? Well, we got a few people in here.
Like a half dozen?
Half dozen or so. So it's not super easy to find on a streaming service right now. It is available for rent or buy. I recommend it if you get a chance to watch it. It's a fantastic movie. It's an 80s movie, so be prepared for like 80s movie pacing, but you could have a lot of you'll have a lot of fun with it.
It lends itself to watching in an altered state.
Yes. I mean, in truth, a lot of Henson stuff can do that. So let's be
cannot find this on streaming services, though, it seems.
No. I'm not entirely sure why. I thought it would be on Disney Plus, and it wasn't. But But for those of you who haven't seen it, definitely check it out. Now, for those of you who have, I want to know if any of you have a favorite scene or a moment in the movie. Chuck and Amy, you guys can go last because I know you will have some. But does anybody have like does anybody have any fond memories of Labyrinth or anything that stands out to them?
It was the ballroom scene. Mm-hmm. When I was a little girl, I wanted that dress that she had.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I want that dress, I want that moment, like that whole scene, just like mesmerizing.
And I think too, what I love about this is it's a movie centered on, you know, a young girl. For me growing up, like I didn't see a lot of movies like that, that weren't Disney movies. So to have a non-Disney thing at the time doing that was interesting.
And she didn't have a boyfriend. She wasn't chasing after a guy. It was her story. It wasn't her inserted into a romance.
Yeah, it wasn't, because there was like hints of that with Jareth, but mm-hmm. but she never really, it never feels like she goes down that path, so...
That was the ballroom scene. I don't know if that got picked up on the mic.
Yeah, sorry, the ballroom scene. September.
So you mentioned the song from the ballroom scene.
Yep.
And that is really special to me, and it's something that my husband Rob, he learned that song for me for a 21st anniversary gift.
Oh, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. The whole MC Escher.
Oh, the stairs at the end. Yes.
And Sarah trying to get to him is just so brilliant. I love it.
Yes, it is. The stairs at the end. And then that's awesome that Rob learned that song for you. That's really cool. Anyone else have like a standout character maybe that they really loved, either that we did talk about or that we didn't talk about? Because, Chuck, I'm pretty sure you love the worm. Wearing a shirt with it, which is great. Amy, how about you?
So I'm partial to the junk lady.
Okay.
The
junk lady.
Because she is performed by Karen Prell, who is also the puppeteer for Red Fraggle.
Ah, okay. So the puppet.
I have IMDb pulled up on here, and I was looking, and the junk lady, you know how when there's actors, there's picture on the side of who they are, and then the characters they play. Her picture on IMDb is red.
Excellent.
She is Red Fraggle.
Okay.
She's fantastic. So, yeah, I love that. And I loved, the thing I love the most about the movie is more, not so much one scene or one set, it's the way that everything is a little different than it seems at first.
Yeah, so, nothing is what it seems to be in that world.
Right. And, like, so, for example, the cleaners, right? Mm-hmm. This giant machining thing that's, like, really scary.
Yeah.
That
the cleaners is like, if you were to take Jim Henson and distill it down into one thing for me, the cleaners is exactly that.
Yeah.
Because it's big, it's scary, and then you get the reveal of what it really is behind it, and it's just a couple little guys and their cranks, and it's got like the, you can hear the weird squeaky noises and all of that, and it breaks all of that tension, but they built it up for you, because up until they get that door broken down, that's a scary scene,
yeah.
And it's incredibly
like the,
tense.
The big mechanical door guard guy,
yeah.
With the axe, you know, and then, like, he gets, you know, you take the head off, and he's, like, this little guy, and then Hoggle throws him out, and he goes, well, that wasn't very nice. <You know? laughs>
There's so many great moments like that, too, where somebody gets tossed out, or when we meet Ludo.
Oh, yeah.
We meet Ludo, and you've got the little guys, and they've got these little, like, chompy things on sticks, and they're just poking at Ludo with them. And then she, you know, she's like, oh, I wish I had something to throw. And, of course, it being the fantasy world, a rock just rolls up for her.
Well, I realized that this morning I was thinking about that. Ludo, like, called for the rocks to help her out.
And, yeah, and then she hits them. You know, they get their helmets spun around. I love it. Who turned out the lights? And they just start running in circles, hitting each other. And probably my single favorite quote in the movie, like line in the movie, as they're running away, and one of them says, oh, my sushi.
Yeah.
Because I had the subtitles were on when I was watching it, and I never realized that they were saying sushi before. But it's just the scene, and all we have is a hedge and these little things running away. Like, that's it. We don't have, that's the entirety of the puppeteering, but you know exactly what's happening, and it just cracks me up every single time. I love all of that stuff, because Henson and all the puppeteers, all the Muppet people were just perfect at that, and they had such a great sense of humor and timing. The timing in everything is just spot on.
Mm-hmm.
I love the hallway with the speaking stones.
Oh, yes.
As well, because, like, they're, you can't go this way, mm-hmm. go back, and then Hoggle's like, yeah, we know you're full of crap. Like, oh, please, I haven't said it in so long.
Yes. Yes, that is.
And that's the same thing. It's like, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those stone faces are just working class stiffs. They just, you know,
got a job to do, got lines to say. I'm going to say them. Yeah, that's another one of those. There's so much in this movie that I either forget is there until I watch it again, or somehow conflate with other things. And I think I did that with the Dark Crystal for a long time, where mm-hmm. there was moments in Labyrinth that I was assuming were Dark Crystal, and then when I actually sat down and watched the movie full through, I'm like, oh. Okay, no, none of that happened in here. Mm-hmm. Shane, did that happen to you a little bit?
Yeah, you know, not as much as I would have thought, actually. Because, yeah, it is, it's a very, yeah, like I said, surprisingly different from the Dark Crystal. Similar tone, maybe, but, yeah. I don't, there was one moment, there was a character that reminded me of, like, is it Magra from Dark Crystal?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, maybe it was
Magra. Agra,
thank you. It might have been the junk lady, actually.
Actually, that's me. I would hear lines from Agra, but be picturing the junk lady saying them. Mm-hmm. Things like "don't know," "don't know," mm-hmm. and then I realized, no, that's the junk lady never says that. But I actually, wait for it every time I watch this movie. I wait for her to say that.
I did make a note, actually. So, oh, it's right here, actually. It was her, but it was Agra, but it was also. She had that one of the Skeksis. Also, I always forget his name because it's Simon Pegg in the series that plays him. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, is it the Chamberlain?
Yeah, yeah. Because she kind of did that thing.
Oh, yeah, too. Yeah. And there's even little moments like the old man with the bird hat.
Oh yeah.
It doesn't have any huge bearing at all. But the movie would be less without that. You know, it's got the all right. It's okay. Stuff like that. It's just it's this collection of little moments that I could nitpick and be like, oh, get rid of this, get rid of that, like the fire stuff. But I don't want any of it gone either. And it's still only an hour and 40 minutes, so it's not. I don't think it's overly bloated or overly long. Even if you know your 13-year-old only made it 45 minutes, yeah. Probably more about attention spans than anything.
Well, yeah, and I think the pacing that people expect and the amount, I think what you were talking about then reminds me of what I said earlier. The movie's kind of a vibe rather than a driving story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she enjoys the Harry Potter movies, which is, you know, there's a lot going on, but it's very plot-driven. The Mockingjay Hunger Games she's been watching recently, which is scary and adventure and high adrenaline. This is not that. This is sort of medium adrenaline and beautiful atmosphere.
Yeah, it's creating a world. The plot of the movie is very simple mm-hmm. and not it doesn't need to. I mean, it's aimed at kids, so you don't want it to be too complex. But I'm always of the mindset of keep the plot of your story relatively simple and let your characters be what's interesting about it. An overly complex plot can be great, but if you have wooden characters, I don't care about what happens to them. In this, I care what's happening to Sarah. I care about the fact that Hoggle, like, wants to help her but is afraid of Jareth, so he keeps trying not to help her while also trying to help her. You know, I care about Ludo.
Yep.
You know, you get the emotional connection to them. And then, it, for me, having seen it as a kid, watching it every time now, I can get transported back to that moment and how I felt then, which is why it's interesting to talk to, you know, you guys having seen it now as adults. And do you think, Shane, do you think if you had seen this as a kid growing up that it would have had a bigger impact?
Absolutely. I believe so. I mean, still enjoyed it, like, appreciate it for what it's worth, but mm-hmm. it's kind of, because it holds up, absolutely. And it's not, in fact, yeah, maybe this would have scared me as a kid, you know?
Yeah, there were definitely parts. I mean, the Helping Hands did, because it's so dark and it's so alien. It's so foreign-looking with these hands and the faces coming out of them, because they like morph into a face as they come together. That one would have scared me. It did scare me as a kid.
Oh, there's a lot. I mean, I was scared of Chuck E. Cheese as a kid, so.
If you've ever been to one, it makes sense. Joe, how about you? Do you think, are you kind of a little bummed out that you missed this?
A little bit, yeah, but I really enjoyed engaging with it for the first time now. I was thinking about you guys talking about having not seen Dark Crystal for ages.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Dark Crystal back then, and it was amazing, and Dark Crystal is older than this.
Yes.
And I was trying to – I probably watching it would have been comparing it to that.
Mm.
And I don't know how that would have benefited me as a, you know, adolescent boy. Because this was definitely – I don't know that I would have had a crush on Jennifer Connelly at that point. And would have been like, well, this is a girl doing a thing. Mm-hmm. But – I think I'm happy with how it progressed. Like, I really liked engaging with it for the first time now. That might just be a Zen attitude, though.
But I think it also does make sense, because at the age, if you were in middle school when this came out,
mm-hmm.
that would be the age where it might not connect with you at that point.
Right.
Because it's not really, like, it's not aimed at necessarily that crowd or that demographic at the time. So I can see that, like, middle school boy.
Right.
Oh,
yeah, actually. And,
in the 80s.
Sarah would have been the same age as my older sister, too. So
oh,
I probably would have been
yeah.
predisposed to be like, ugh.
There's a disconnect right there.
Yeah, my older sister keeps saying things aren't fair, and she's horrible.
Well, and that's one of the – oh, yeah.
I have a quick question.
Absolutely.
In the New York Times had an article recently about how eldest sisters
mm-hmm. – Yeah, so the question is, you know, how much Sarah being the elder daughter plays into her character. I think so, and I think even if it wasn't a conscious decision by Henson as writing it to go with that particular thought, I think that it certainly plays into it. Yeah, and – sorry, you had some.
No, I was thinking part of the dynamic that was in that one – in the movie for me was thinking about the – combined family and that it was her stepbrother.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in the 80s, that was a whole wealth of new ground to talk about and discuss, whereas now it just seems like that's of course families combine. And that mixed, like, I mean, one of the ways you could think about the conclusion of this story is Sarah finally accepts Toby as her sibling, when up to that point he had just been an annoying interjection into her life, and she missed her mom and her real family, and this was not it.
Yeah.
Which I think probably overlaps with the eldest being very responsible but a little resentful, but also leans into that sort of that divorced and remarried dynamic even more so.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to dive into characters like that, and not being an elder, like, I'm an older sibling, but the age difference was so minimal with my sister growing up that it basically might as well have been nothing. Like, I didn't have a lot of she trying to tag along with me or anything like that, because it just didn't work out that way. But yeah. And I think, too, kind of going back to what we were talking about seeing it as an adult versus younger, I think because we're always – every time you see a movie, you're a different person. And being, you know – being your age now, having children of your own,
right.
I think will alter your perception on a movie like this. For me, I know seeing it as a kid, it was all about the Muppets, and it was all about just the fun adventure of it. And every time I watch it now, I get a little something different from it. I take a little something away that I didn't before, whether it's appreciating more technical stuff as I get more interested in, like, puppeteering, or finding things like characterization for her, because Sarah, you know, everything's unfair for Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is. And so, and the goblin world is inherently unfair, and it, you know, naturally, because it just is always changing, because that's, it's goblins. That's what they do. They don't, they cheat. So, yeah, it's kind of fun stuff. Amy, you have a question.
So, on that note, yes. I mean, did you, I'm curious to know, did any of you, and Travis, you particularly, since you've seen it multiple times, mm-hmm. like, have probably picked up on, it's a metaphor for a coming-of-age story mm-hmm. for her. Like, she's sort of letting go, especially the junk lady scene, right? Like,
she's, yeah.
She's trying to let go of her attachment to her more childish things and her more childish attitudes.
Yep.
You know, and so I just wondered if you guys, when watching it, if you picked up on any of that, like some of the more metaphorical stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so question being, did any of us pick up on kind of the metaphor of the coming of age stuff for that? I know the first couple of times that I saw it, no, not at all, because it just would have, it all sailed over my head. But I do notice that now, and it very much is, because she, at 16, you're not a child anymore, but you're not an adult. You're not fully baked yet. And you don't want to let go of that, because there is an innocence and a simplicity to all of it. And to let go of those things is to say that I don't need that anymore, but that's scary. And so adding the layer, like putting the metaphor in there and having it all be, you know, her getting her little brother back because of the king of the goblins stealing him, which is straight out of the fantasy she's been living. In her own head, is great. So I notice it now. I pick up on it quite a bit more now. How about either of you, Shane, did you kind of pick up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Yeah, for sure. I thought it was pretty, even if I wasn't necessarily thinking about it consciously, I think it was, yeah, I noticed it.
So one of the things for me in watching it was I've been, I don't know, wrestling with or arguing against the hero's journey being the one true story of all stories.
Mm-hmm.
That argument's been frustrating me for the last year or so, to the point where I started picking up Joseph Campbell and actually reading his book, which is a slog. but realizing that this is not, and I don't know that, I mean, George Lucas was involved with this as a producer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Lucas is famous for talking about hero's journey. Henson, I assume, because I put him on a pedestal, that Henson deliberately didn't write this as a hero's journey. It does not follow that path exactly. It follows a different path that's also a pretty archetypal path of growth. And I was tracking that, and that there's the rejection of this junk stuff. But in the end, you have new things, and those new things are the companions that you had along the way that then come back when you need them again. You've created a new community through the process of this trial, and that was the one theme that jumped out to me. At first jumped out to me in a little bit of a silly way. I mean, I loved the moment when she sees them in the mirror and they remind her, just call and whenever you need me and we'll be there. And she does. And the they was Hago, Ludo, Didymus. But then when she calls back, there's them, there's the fire creatures, there's the goblins. Like, everyone's back there. I think even the junk lady. But I love that, for me, the metaphor there was creating a community through your challenges that then becomes support you have moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, and It's just a fantastic movie through and through, and you can take so much more. Like, I hope you get a chance to watch it again, and maybe get your 13-year-old to sit through the whole thing, because I'd be curious to hear what they thought of it watching all the way through.
Sure. Well, you know, she's a 13-year-old girl. This is a story for her to think about, although she is the youngest, which I don't know if, as to the question earlier, if she is manipulative in that way, but But she's also raised by two parents who were the youngest in their family, so we know the ways of the youngest child.
You can smell your own. Yeah, no, I get it. I get it.
Hey, can I ask a question or make a comment about sort of production stuff?
We no, absolutely.
Really interested. No. So one of the things that popped up often during the movie for my wife and I was hearing different little segments or leitmotifs going on in the score.
Mm-hmm.
That felt like a greatest hits of 80s score. Like, we're like, oh, that sounds a little bit like Indiana Jones. That sounds a little bit... There was just a like a five-note riff that played. I was like, that sounds like Top Gun music. And there were these different... Yeah. Like, yeah. It felt musically like you took all the 80s and put it together into a musical stew. And I looked up just to see, out of curiosity. One, easily overshadowed because the... You know, the soundtrack is David Bowie, but the score and was by a guy named Trevor Jones. Mm. And I thought maybe he did these other movies. He didn't do any of those. He didn't do Top Gun or Indiana Jones or any of those guys. He did do The Dark Crystal.
Okay.
And he did the Labyrinth TV show that happened a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He has, 30 plus, 40 plus years of consistent work doing scores for movies and TV shows, which is kind of amazing, that just the longevity of that. But it was really, I don't know if you guys, when you listened to the music, did you feel the sort of 80s pull from it, or did it just blend in for you?
It kind of did both. I mean, I definitely felt it because they would have musical motifs that hit emotional beats.
Mm-hmm.
But it does the thing that I like. A good score can do one of two things for me. It either is John Williams and it really stands out, and you know it. You immediately know the music from Indiana Jones the second you hear it because he creates that melody and it's there. Or it blends in and it creates the atmosphere and the emotional backing in a scene, and it kind of melts into it where – it's like salt in your food. You don't notice it till it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And the music changing, like changing the music in this movie and removing that, not just the soundtrack stuff, but all of that score makes a huge difference. So I think that the music, all of Bowie's stuff and Dance Magic Dance and those songs, those are the John Williams stuff. Those are the standouts that you remember that get stuck in your head for days. But the score then is there as the foundation and ties it all together. So that's kind of how it was for me. How about you, Shane?
Yeah, totally. It's
as the music guy, you probably know more about it than I do.
Oh, I don't know about that. I thought the music was great. I certainly got that 80s vibe as well. Like I think it was pretty obvious at times, but I agree. It was good. It went with it. It went well with the movie, and so much so that maybe I wasn't necessarily noticing it as much at times, like you said. Take it away, I'm sure the whole feel changes completely, right?
Yeah, it's all the parts. All of the parts come together to make something that's even better than they are, and they're all fantastic. Trevor Jones's music, Bowie, the acting, the sets, the costumes, the Muppets, and all of that. And then you get Jim Henson, you know, overseeing everything and bringing it together and giving you a movie that 40 years on is still fantastic to watch and open to new generations too. And I think that's one of the things that Henson in his productions that I love so much is that I liked it. I have, you know, friends and family members that are older than me that were into it and then younger, and we're seeing the resurgence of it with things like the Dark Crystal series. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say, so there was a Labyrinth one as well?
So evidently... And I only know this because of IMDb. There was a 2012 Labyrinth miniseries.
Okay.
That Trevor Jones was a composer on as well as doing the original. I don't know anything about that. That totally passed under my radar.
Yeah, I'd be curious if the Goblin King is in that as well, or who plays him.
I don't know. And don't feel bad about the IMDb thing. 80% of my knowledge is IMDb and Wikipedia, so I don't really know anything. I just regurgitate.
Here's something else I learned from IMDb out of curiosity. Like, okay, baby Toby, the baby. Like, what has he ever done since then?
He founded
Leica. Oh, my word. I didn't notice that. What I noticed was that he made a puppet-based short fantasy movie in 2014. that now I'm going to go try and find. It's called Lessons Learned. And I was like, that's amazing that he, like, came back to this. Because at that age, I don't imagine... Imagine most of his experience of this movie is people telling him about how great it was that he was in it. Because being that young, it's not something that you remember so deeply.
Except, no, not at all. Unless every time he sees a Muppet, he just has flashbacks.
Yeah. But that was really intriguing to see that he circled back to that same space.
That's great, though. I didn't realize that he had founded Laika either, so that's cool info.
I don't think he was a founder, actually. That was in the speech.
Oh, okay.
But he was one of the producers of Kubo and the Two Strings.
Oh, okay. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, as a toddler in the movie, he was enjoyable. Like, he was good. He basically had to stand there and look scared all the time, right. And he did it well.
Yeah. We had this conversation after the movie that asking a toddler to act scared is probably one of the easiest jobs to give them. Like, be frightened. Here's David Bowie with a wig.
Right.
And for some reason, the baby seemed happier around Bowie ultimately.
I mean, I would have been. Let's be real. Again, it's David Bowie.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
And all the design for everything on the Dark Crystal and a fair amount on the movie as well. So, and their old house sold for millions and millions of pounds because it looks like those sets. So he was used to being around scary stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, that's...
Excellent. Which was great, I thought. Mm-hmm. Wish it still was around.
Yeah, that is on my short list of things to watch when I have free time to watch something just for me. Or I'll have to do a spinoff of this show, series-based, just to make myself watch it.
I'm not going to spoil anything. I'll just say there's a character named Hup that will be your favorite.
Excellent. Well, Shane, Joe, thank you so much for doing this. It took us a year to get it done, but we did. And you guys got to see Labyrinth. I'm so happy. And I'm so happy that you enjoyed it, too.
It was absolutely wonderful. I'm so excited that I got to watch it.
Because this was, I mean, this is a big one for me. So for both of you to get to see it and to enjoy it is great. And for those of you here with us in Las Vegas who haven't seen it, check it out. It's really, really good. And for the rest of you, watch it again. If you haven't watched it in a while, watch it again because it holds up. It's really good. So thank you both for being here. This was a ton of fun.
Thank you.
You're reimbursing my travel, right?
Yeah. Yeah, your check's in the mail. Don't worry. And thank all of you in the audience for being here today. This was really cool. So if you enjoy this show, I do it weekly, and I stream every typically Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern time at twitch.tv/TVStravis or on YouTube at TVStravis. And the show comes out on Wednesdays as a podcast, everywhere you can get podcasts, YouTube as well, a video version, because usually I have a camera on me. And you can also go to tvstravis.com. You can find this show. You can find other shows I do. I do three other podcasts beyond this one, Classic Television. I have one winding down all on Highlander. And also I'm part of Gore, and we do all horror movies on there. So you can check out all those at tvstravis.com. There's links. If you ever want to get my silly logo on something, I've got merchandise as well. And there's a Patreon. So check all those out. And thank you all for being here. This was super, super fun. Joe, Shane, thank you again. We'll do this again sometime.
Okay.
Sounds great.
All next right. year.
Tra-la-la!